Hey guys, it's your host Julian. This week is our Powerpuff Girls reunion with Craig McCracken, Lauren Faust, Linda Semensky, Chris Battle, and Fred Seibert. I want to give a special shout out to a couple of our patrons that helped make this podcast possible. Bill, Brent, Brittany, Call Me Spikey, Eight-Legged Bird, Jacob, and Nick. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a patron and help support this show, check the show notes below and sign up today. Now, let's get to my Powerpuff Girls reunion.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to What's My Head Podcast. I'm your host Julian. Today I'm joined by Fred. Welcome back, Fred. How are you?
How you doing, Julian?
Fantastic as always. Chris, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, Julian.
Absolutely, man. Linda, always a pleasure. How are you?
I'm good, Julian. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. And first time guest, Miss Lauren Faust. Lauren, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And the man without no show, we would not be talking, Mr. Craig McCracken. Craig, how are you?
Nice to be back. Good to see you.
Oh, it's nice to have you, and it's nice to be back, man. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to bury the lead just a little bit. We're talking Powerpuff Girls reunion. One question and one topic everybody was so fevered for me to ask was your Space Ghost Coast to Coast debut in that amazing, amazing bathing suit that matched your eyes quite splendidly. So you walk us through that beautiful day that everybody wants to know about?
I mean, basically what happened is Lazo called me and said, hey, you're going to win the world premiere tune-in. Powerpuff's going to be the short we're going to show. But you need to go get a swimsuit. Will you let us film you in a swimsuit? That was the caveat. And I'm like, absolutely, yeah. So I said, can I wear whatever I want? And he said, of course. So I went to like a Hollywood costume place and rented like an old-timey, you know, 1900s wool swimsuit. And then went and bought a bunch of paraphernalia like floaties and goggles and flippers. And then just showed up at the Hanna-Barbera mix stage for like an hour. And they were like, all right, let's just get you walking down here. Hold these roses. Here's a crown. Say some stuff. And that was about the extent of it. It was like a very short period in my workday at Hanna-Barbera. But it's become this thing. But like the idea was Mike's, like, you're going to win a swimsuit. I'm assuming, I don't know who really came up with the idea in Atlanta, but it came from there. And it was just like, yeah, will you do this? And I was like, absolutely. And it's those sort of things that made me love working for Cartoon Network. That like, that was the idea I was getting pitched from the executives, is wear a swimsuit so you can wear a swimsuit competition. So that was, it's like, I'm at the right place. Working in
it life. Was one of the few places where the executives were crazier than the creators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I went to Atlanta, Lazo didn't have an office. You would assume he would, but he had a cubicle, and the inside of it was painted with demonic My Little Ponies, like a mural. So I'm like, this is a good place to work.
That's my guy right there. Yeah. I've never shared this, and Fred will get you in just a second, but I've never shared this. I remember sitting down and watching that world premiere tunes, what would later be What a Cartoon, what should have been What a Cartoon, and then my mom walking by and going, why are you watching a grown man in a bathing suit? And I was like, it's cartoons, Mom. And mind you, I'm 7, 8-ish at the time, and I just remember having to like say, Mom, this is okay, this is cartoons. So you've been a common question in my household since I was a very little kid, Craig.
Great.
In the best possible way.
I'm glad to put it to rest.
Absolutely.
There's no drama behind it.
No drama whatsoever. Now, Fred, obviously, you know, you started that What a Cartoon short program to revive and produce the second golden age of animation, really. When was the first time? Oh, you knocked it out of the park, man. You guys crushed it. When was the first time you remember bumping into or seeing some of Craig's work? How'd you know Powerpuff Girls had to be a thing?
Well, you know, when we announced that we were doing the shorts, among the first people that besieged us were the crew from Two Stupid Dogs. Mm-hmm. They were all in the business. You know, I don't want to speak for Craig, but I've spoken to a number of them. And they all went to school at a time where cartoons were dead. You know, everything was like really bad half hour versions of live action shows or movies or toys or something. But they all wanted to be in cartoons and nobody was going to let them. Two Stupid Dogs is one of the early shows that really sort of like put a spotlight on that kind of thing. We even formatted it like a classic Hanna-Barbera show from the 50s with 3 6-minute cartoons, you know, across there. And so the team came in and everybody had their thing. And I'm not exactly sure how we ended up in the basement, Craig and I and a couple other people, in the basement of Hanna-Barbera with a tiny little color monitor. I'm not sure why we weren't somewhere with a big TV, or, you know, maybe you know, Craig. And a tape goes in. And up comes the title, The Whoop-Ass Girls. And I didn't want to say anything, but I was already in.
Yeah.
I was actually really depressed when we changed the name, you know, at a certain point. And everything about it was like, you know, my eyes were popping out of my head. And then there was something about, like, when the girls, like, took off and the trails that they left behind, I went, okay, we have to do this. And I think I said to Craig right away, storyboard up a short, let's go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I remember.
It was as simple as that.
That was actually pre What a Cartoon, because I had,
yep.
We were still working on Dogs, and I had gone up to Margo McDonough's office and showed her, you know, Whoop-Ass. And mm-hmm. She said, I'm not supposed to do this. But she bypassed the entire development department, took me down to your office. Then we found the VHS tape in the basement. We watched it, and you were like, yeah, let's go. So I walked back into that was 1993. I walked back in the trailer, and I said, I think I just sold Whoop-Ass Girls. So we were all like, okay, this is what we're doing next, you know. But then what had happened is the interim, while we were waiting for that deal to happen, What a Cartoon came into play, and Fred said, we still want to do Whoop-Ass, but we want to do a short. Like, so do a board for a short. And then we went in and pitched. And that was the same thing. That's how, like,
a 25 minute, you pitch a 25 minute short.
Yeah. It was pretty big. It was big. I still do that. But like Gendy, he had his student film, and Larry Huber, who was a producer with us on the shorts, he went to Gendy and said, you should pitch your student film as a short in this program. So that's how we kind of both got into that program.
Do you remember how far Whoop-Ass Girls made it as far as the name goes before they said, hey, we got to change it?
It was all the way, we recorded it. So it was all the way, from what I heard, it was all the way in production. Laza was talking to some cable buyers somewhere in the South and said, like, yeah, we have this cartoon called The Whoop-Ass Girls. And they went, wait, what? So then I got the call to, like, change the name. And I was kind of waiting for it. But, yeah, it eventually happened.
And we tried. We tried.
Yeah, we tried.
Did you have Powerpuff Girls lined up right away, or did it take you some time to flesh out that name?
No, it took a long time. I had lots of people on it. I had different friends on it. Like, we needed a name. And it took a long time to, like, go, okay, that's what it'll be.
Do you remember
when
the spark?
My 4-year-olds and my friends fell in love with the show, I was really glad we had changed the name.
Yeah,
I have to say.
Yeah, me too.
All right, so let's start with Chris, and then we'll go over to Linda, and then we'll go with Lauren. But how do you start filling out this team, Craig? How do you start getting the writers? I'm assuming the executives were assigned to specific shows, or could you select the executives at that time, or no?
No, not when we were doing the shorts or when we were doing the show.
Both. When you got the short going, you've already got that one greenlit. But
we in the shorts going, Larry Huber was kind of the default producer for all the shorts. Mm-hmm. So he was just our guy who was telling us how to make this stuff, you know. And one thing that I loved about Hanna-Barbera is that, you know, when I went to CalArts, they taught you the craft, or not the art of animation and how to think about it creatively. But when you go to Hanna-Barbera, they teach you the ins and out trade of the business of animation. And, like, it's a whole different thing, learning, like, oh, this is how the sausage is made. This is how we have to do it. This is the time we have. These are the budget limitations. So, like, getting into that environment and learning how to do that was invaluable. So Larry Huber was a longtime producer of cartoons, going back through HB and Ruby Spears and stuff. And he was put on the shorts to just be our day-to-day guy. But we were answering to Mike and Linda. I mean, that's who were giving us notes and feedback. But once we pitched it to them and they were like, yeah, let's make it, we kind of were left alone to just go make it, you know?
That's the philosophy.
Yeah.
Right. Like if we had something to say, why didn't we just make our own cartoons?
Right.
And, you know, I always said that my goal was to set up a person who is completely capable if we all like got run over by cars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that team, I mean, I have to say almost everybody that came out of the Two Stupid Dogs team that made shorts for us, you know, fulfilled that dream of, wow, this is really possible. You know, you need to know that in the sort of outer world, meaning outside of my office and a couple of people, everyone thought this was the stupidest idea in the world. And the old guard, of which Larry was part of, but separate in his mind, was separate from everybody else's, they were angry at me, actually, for empowering all these young people who had never done anything, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that I sort of gave orders to leave them alone was like kind of shocking. Even, I have to say, a couple of the guys, contemporaries from Cal Arts, who were in so-called junior executive positions, wanted to mess around with them and, you know, tell them what colors to use and, you know, put fingers on the Powerpuff Girls, you know, whatever it was. And even they had to be sort of slapped back to say, we've said yes, that means they get to go and get out of the way.
Well, I'm glad it was folks like you and Linda that were there to, you know, Linda, you know, I want to talk to you for just, or talk about you for just a second, because everybody that I've ever had that's had you attached to their show has always said the same thing. She kept the people that needed to be in the sandbox playing into the sandbox playing, and any of the outside forces, the outside voices that would come in and just flip the table or flip the sandbox up, you kept them at bay. So thank you. And thank you, Fred, for doing what you guys do and giving these guys, these artists and these gals, the room to grow, the room to fail, and the room to succeed, man, because without that, we wouldn't have this great piece of these great decades long for Craig, for Lauren, for Chris, for Linda, for Fred, of just beautiful animation that so many of us grew up enjoying. So thank you all for that.
Let me put in a word for Linda. When we were both at Nickelodeon, I didn't really know Linda, you know, too much. We were in different groups. And one day when I was getting divorced and I had nothing to do on the weekends, I started hanging out in a Village comic book store. And Linda came up and buttonholed me one day, like when I was, I don't know what I was, probably buying inappropriate material. And just started going off on like why Nickelodeon, like they weren't doing it right. And the people weren't, you know, it was like, you could tell that she was passionate then and was going to figure out her way into the game. At the time, she hoped at Nickelodeon, but at the time they were hopeless. And, you know, Lazo turned out to be, like with many people, a hero in that situation, where he understood immediately who Linda was and what kind of executive, special and unique executive she would be in the modern cartoon business.
Thank you, Linda. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Fred. You know, I think part of it was I inherited a weird trait from my mom, which is we got in trouble. We thought it was funny. And, you know, like to argue, like to disagree, you know, like to sort of, you know, protect the, you know, the people who, you know, we'd made promises to. And you know, I can remember just the whole time I was growing up, my mom would always say things. And I as a little kid, I'd think, well, why did you have to say that? Now there's going to be an argument. And, you know, but she was just kind of standing up for what she thought was right. And, you know, and then I grew up to inherit that trait. And so I would find myself in these situations and, you know, I'd be like being called down to someone's office for one thing or another. And I'd think, oh, man, you know, if I get fired for doing this, that would be so funny. I'd have this story to tell for the rest of my career that, you know, I got fired for approving, something with the word stupid in it too many times. And so I'd be like ready for that. And, you know, that lasted till like somewhere in the middle of my job at PBS where I realized that, you know, they weren't actually going to fire me for anything like that. And that, you know, the more argumentative I got, the more it made people sad. So I just kind of stopped. You know? Remembered I had kids and needed to feed them. And, you know, I calmed down a little bit. But, you know, I sort of saw every argument people wanted to have as, like, you know, fun. And I'm not even that argumentative a person, really. But, you know, I was just like more than happy to go to the mat for anyone who, you know, so I was constantly being called down. And, you know, we have a complaint or we're reading this board and the head of standards is concerned because of this or that. And, you know, I would just argue for it until they'd say things to me like, do you want a focus group where, you know, we have kids and their parents and their 5-year-olds looking at this and they'll decide? And I'd be like, no. And I'd sulk out and, you know, and there was something about Cartoon Network, which just made us all sort of become whatever weird quirks we had. They just got weirder at Cartoon Network. You know, there was like this encouragement that, you know, sort of like the more, you know, you sort of fought for the things you thought were right, and the more attention you brought up, you know, bad attention you brought on yourself, you know, the funnier it would be, or, you know, the more people would like you. And so I was pretty happy there. And then when that culture went away, I was like, this isn't really that much fun anymore. Like when everyone was like all like into being a good corporate executive and, you know, like not only good behavior, but almost like activist executiving, you know, where you'd be like looking at things and saying, I have some fixes for you. And they'd be your opinion completely. And I would be like, didn't we sign an oath? And it turned out, no, the oath had been canceled. And, you know, we were going to be just like every place else. And I was like, I don't know. This isn't where I want to be. And so I went to PBS where I was sort of like a rabble rouser for 18 years, and they kept me around because, you know, I was like the in-house complainer, and you know, I was, you know, perfectly willing to have whatever conversation no one else wanted to have. And I, you know, sometimes like if it looked really hard, I'd think, what would Jeri Laybourne do? Because she was sort of like a good role model for me, you know. It seemed like she would never shy away from, you know, something because she didn't feel like doing it. She'd be, and maybe I was fantasizing this, but I'd be like, Jeri would fight, I'll fight. And so, you know, I took on all sorts of arguments. And it's very interesting because I work for a company now where people generally don't argue. They're kind of in sync. They're cordial. And, you know, it's very civilized. And, you know, I'm older, so it all works. But, you know, I think I was argumentative at a time when people needed me to be argumentative. And that's really just the truth to it. I was like, I had promised these people I was going to protect their vision. And, you know, if it meant I was going down, that would be fine. And I think that's, you know, kind of the attitude that one must have in jobs like that, at times like that. So, you know,
I think also, if I could add in, I'm going to speak for Linda and Mike here, though I have no right to. None of us had anything to lose at that time in our lives. You know, like I thought I just needed to go to LA to get away from my ex-partner and my ex-clients and my ex-wife. Like I just needed a new life, and I didn't think it would work. You know, so you just go for the gold when you do that, when you don't think. And Craig, you weren't married yet, you know, you didn't have kids yet. Like, you know, we were like the insane people who had taken over the asylum.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that really worked. And I put in one more person in here who's unsung in all of this, and that's Buzz Potamkin, who I had brought in to run production for me. He had done a lot of stuff for me at MTV. And honestly, I had vetted through the notion of the shorts with him years before I got to Hanna-Barbera when Nickelodeon told me it was really stupid and they would never do it. And he worked out everything that I needed to work out so that I could go and beg Ted Turner for another $10 million to make these shorts when I had already blown the budget on Two Stupid Dogs and SWAT Cats, the Radical Squadron, which didn't work. You know, none of them worked. And we were broke again. And if it wasn't for Buzz, I never would have had the guts to go and do all the various things, because there was one guy who thought, sure, this is a great idea. We should do it.
All right, as we take a pause for the cause, if you haven't yet, you should check us out on all social media platforms by searching at In My Head Pod. There you can see who we've got coming on, and if you feel so inclined to, you could submit a question to be asked. Now, let's get back to the show.
Yeah, the other thing that happened is when we got those shorts, we did not assume this was going to be our careers. We were like, we have a very rare opportunity right now where this window has opened up to do what we've always wanted to do. We better not let this disappear. So Gendy and I were both like obsessed with just doing the best work we possibly could, because we didn't know it might go away at any time. Even when we
That's got for the sure.
Even when we got the pickup for Dexter's, it was only 6 half hours. So we're like, this might be it. Because we had been at CalArts and we had watched, you know, Nickelodeon fire John Kay. So we knew that creators can lose their shows. So this is a possibility. So we're like, this is a very rare opportunity, and we're not going to let this pass us by, you know.
Well, I'm glad you guys held on to it.
Everyone at Turner did not want it to work on the business side of Turner.
Right.
That's why they only gave us 6 episodes. And it took us a year to convince them to give us 6 episodes.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But well, remember, at that time, original programming was not it was not the mainstream of cable television. Right. You know, Nickelodeon had done some, MTV had done some, but not very many people had done original. And there was no sense that there was a business model that it would pay back.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. You know, you're right. But, you know, I remember at Nick, we had this feeling that if we did things right, that we were going to save animation, you know?
Yes.
So it's like
we were very naive.
I personally, you know, I had nothing to lose, but like career wise, I felt like we collectively, you know, and then I would say Cartoon Network and Nick together, because it was a lot of the same people.
Sure.
You know, we all kind of felt like, you know, if we did it right, we would save animation. And, you know, I wanted to save animation. I didn't want to save animation as it was. I sort of wanted, and you know, this new version of it to be, you know, the thing. And I, you know, I can remember the pressure we all felt from that. And at Nickelodeon, we just argued all the time about everything, because we all felt this incredible pressure to get things right. And everyone always thought they were right as well. And so, you know, it was just a lot of arguing. And what I liked about Cartoon Network is there was less arguing. You know, it was more sort of like people were sort of in sync, but also had this feeling like we should get this right. You know, we should do the right thing. And it would be good for animation if, you know, if animation's still around in 20 years. And, you know, we didn't know for sure if it would be or not. But, you know,
You guys were also fighting up against Nickelodeon because you were pure animation and they just had some stuff. And it was not really clear, you know, there's a lot of conventional wisdom out there that having an all Cartoon Network was a really stupid idea. In fact, even some of the executives at Cartoon Network would say to me sort of quietly, well, you know, Nickelodeon's already there and they're really popular. And what do we say about ourselves? We don't have anything to say. And I said, well, you know, you are the first Cartoon Network and being first is good. And then mm-hmm. went, do you think anyone will really care? I said, if you say it right, they'll care. If you say it wrong, they'll think you're idiots. But, you know, they said it right.
Well, I will say there's many people. This mural back behind me, Cartoon Network cares. It still cares. And we truly miss those checkerboard days. Now, getting it back from pilot to series. Now, Fred, anytime you want to dip out, just let me know and then I'll ask you that question.
We should do that now, because I was gone years before it went to series, because we had done a series of focus groups that I think Craig was ready to kill himself. I think he really quit the studio right after those focus groups.
Yeah.
For several months, right?
Yeah.
Again, I remember very vividly the young boy who said, when they said, "What do you think about it?" He goes, "But they have no fingers. I don't like it."
Yeah.
You know,
the quote I took from that focus group was, "Whoever made this cartoon, this is the worst cartoon ever made, and whoever made it should be fired."
Jesus Christ.
That was my first professional outing.
I was like, well, I mean, it's all uphill from there. It's all uphill from there, I suppose. I mean, if you're starting on the bottom.
Well, like I said, did you leave? You went to Disney or something for 6 months?
I left for a while. Well, because we had finished the shorts and we hadn't gotten a pickup on Dexter. So it was like, I guess I'll go see what I can do somewhere else. And then eventually Gandy called me and said, "Hey, we got the 6. Do you want to come back and help on these?" I'm like, okay. But we didn't know it was going to happen. We just made all these shorts and then it was done. They aired and that was it. We didn't know what would happen.
And the rest is history, as they like to say. But Fred, that question is, if you can go back in time and tell your younger self anything, any piece of advice whatsoever, what would it be?
Well, I took the advice. Mm-hmm. Like when you fail, like pick yourself up, dust yourself off and keep going. And I'm always giving advice to, because I was just at a college class yesterday and somebody asked the same question. And I said, you know, objectively, if you look at our business, not just the animation business, all of the entertainment business, I think it's pretty easy to say it's impossible to succeed. If you were to like to make the check boxes of what you need to do to succeed, like everybody would not do it. And those of us who did are just too damn stupid. Like to stop, right? Yeah. And I'm at the front of that line. Like, you know, I've fallen down in the mud more times than I can tell you. I was really angry every minute of every day when Nickelodeon told me that the idea of doing these shorts was stupid. And I was angry for at least, I took the job at Hanna-Barbera solely because I was so angry about that. And honestly, my boss, Scott Sassett, told me that Ted Turner would never agree to it. But I still took the job because at least there was some hope. You know, but at Nickelodeon, they just shined it on. And I was like viscerally upset for a really long time, mainly because, you know, who likes people to disagree with them? You know, I don't anyway.
Got you. Well, thank you for answering that, Fred. And then thank you for your time. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. Great seeing you all. Have a great series. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Fred. All right. So since we're talking, we already walked through the pilot. And like I said, I don't want you to have to revisit that that critique you got. You should be fired. Worst thing ever again.
That ever happened to me. Honestly, it really was one of the best things that ever happened
about
to me.
The drawings you did afterwards.
Well, yeah. So for a while, I tried to redesign the girls. I thought they're too weird. I gave them fingers. I gave them noses, ears. And I did all this stuff. I was like, they're just too strange. And I was doing it. Paul Roosh and I were doing all this stuff. And somehow Mike Lazo heard that I was trying to change it. And he called me up and he said, "Hey, we really love what you're doing. We love your vision for Powerpuff. It looks amazing. It's great. Don't change it. It didn't work, but figure out what didn't work and do better next time." So it was just like, we like your love your vision and we want you to do what you do. Don't change it because we want you to be yourself. And the fact that I got, and here's the other thing he said, he's like, "I'm really interested in those focus test results because they hated Powerpuff." Mm-hmm. But that makes me really interested because the focus test results I'm worried about are the lukewarm. "Yeah, that was okay." He was like, "I either want them to love it or to hate it, because if they hated it, that meant there's something there they want to like and they were mad at it. So figure out like what it was they didn't like." And I went, "Okay, all right." And then so when I went to do the shorts or the series, finally, I learned tons of lessons from those shorts and applied all of it to everything I did afterwards. Everything I did on Dexter's, everything I did on Powerpuff, I learned from those shorts.
Well, that's a valuable learning lesson right there. Yeah. So since we're into series, obviously Chris and Lauren come into this series to help with Powerpuff Girls. So how do you get Chris? We'll end on Lauren as far as getting on, because you know we got to save the best for last. We got to have Lauren go last. You know what I mean? So Chris, how does Chris become a mainstay on Powerpuff Girls?
Well, I was lucky enough that those of us who were working on Dexter's Lab were all just rolled over into Powerpuff Girls. And you know, it's kind of funny that just to roll it back even further is that before I was at Hanna-Barbera, I was at another studio along with a lot of other artists who would wind up being my fellow crew members on Powerpuff Girls. And we were seeing the shorts that were coming out of Hanna-Barbera. And out of those 65, definitely among the top handful was Dexter's Laboratory and Powerpuff Girls. We thought, those are great. That's the kind of stuff that we wanted to work on. When we found out there were people our own age in our early to mid 20s, we just thought, well, that's why that's gelling with us. And you know, we just really wanted to work on that, but we thought, you know, what are the chances? And one of the character designers on the show I was working at, Dave Smith, he left the show to go join up on that initial Order of Dexter's Laboratory to do storyboards, because he went to CalArts with Craig and Gendy. And so after that, one of our other designers, Dan Kroll, left. And so I just said, well, I got to go over there to Hanna-Barbera and see what's going on. And so luckily, they extended an invitation to me and then later Jim Worthy as well. And that was, you know, a good portion of the Dexter's Laboratory crew. So we had a great time working on that. I mean, that's just the dream, working on those great projects like that, a great show. And usually in animation, you work on something, you develop these friendships. Maybe that's over in a year and don't get a renewal. But I mean, we kept getting, I can't remember if we had another season after that. And then we thought, okay, that's going to be it. And already before we were even done with Dexter's, Craig was already working on Powerpuff Girls. And they said, we're just going to do that next. We're like, awesome. You know, so that's so I just lucked in there right at the right time. And then just we got to go on and make something even better.
Oh, yeah, man. And I wasn't even trying to sell the show. I mean, I wasn't pitching it. I was like, I guess I'll just work for Gendy and do boards and art direct for my career. That'll be okay. So I wasn't like out there pushing Powerpuff. Mike and Linda came to me and said, we're going to greenlight the show. I'm like, what? And it was a total surprise. It was like, we want to keep the crew together. We've been getting... people have been contacting us about Powerpuff over the years, and Linda really loved my work on Dexter's and wanted to give me a shot.
Well, so, I went to Lazo and I had said, you know, if we do this show, we could keep the whole team together after Dexter's over, and that sounds good, right? And I was sort of basing my opinion on, well, I like it, and lots of people have asked about it, and you know, and when I saw your board that made me laugh, I was like, oh, he could fix it. He'd be fine. And I remember Lazo said to me, are you sure you really want to push this? Because, you know, it didn't test well. And I was like, oh, bah, whatever. And I was like, yeah, I feel pretty sincere about this. I really want to push for it. And then the other thing I pushed for was I looked at Craig's deal and I was like, nah. I was like, you know, this guy, he's awesome. Someone's going to grab him. And, you know, so we have to give him a new deal that like shows how interested we are. And Lazo was like, good idea. And I remember a couple of executives saying to me, you know, this may not work. And I was like, well, you know, what show ever do you go in saying, well, this is a hit? Because, you know, a lot of times those are not the ones that work anyway. And so I think if I had been like a better, maybe more sensitive, more career oriented executive, this wouldn't have happened. But I wasn't that. I was like, you know, I want to change animation and this is the show. And, you know, these are the people. And so, you know, and also I was very... The one thing I was good at was competing with Nickelodeon, you know, and I was like, you know, I don't want them to go to Nick. They're too good. We have to keep them. And so, you know, I had all of this going on. So I was, and you know, it wasn't really that hard. That was the cool thing. It wasn't like people were like, no, they were like, okay, let's try. And Lazo, of course, was very supportive. You know, once we got past that first conversation where he kind of double checked, "You sure?" "Yes." "Okay, then." And then he supported me. And the thing that I remember thinking years later was that, like, there are a lot of questions you have to ask when you're doing something like this. I didn't ask any of them. I was just completely like going with my gut. And it, you know, and that same gut also caused me to do all sorts of things, you know, get a lot of things wrong, you know. I, you know, but the truth is, you know, you only have to get a few things right, really. That's, you know, the odds are against you anyway. I think most people never get anything really right. So I kind of felt like, well, you know, this is one of those things where I feel very strongly. And Jerry Laybourne would have said, "Now go do research." No research, you know. I the research was done, wasn't on my side. So I was like, complete gut. And, you know, that made me think from then on, I should, you know, trust my gut, which was not correct, but, you know, it was right once and, you know, that worked. So there was, you know, I think if anybody at Cartoon Network had been more logical, there probably would have been more questions, but, you know, everybody was more sort of, everybody liked Craig. So, you know, it was sort of like we're rooting and, you know, everyone liked Powerpuff Girls. So I think everybody thought they were going to be making it anyway. So it just seemed right to everyone. Well, yeah, now we're making it. Okay, great. So, you know, it wasn't dramatic or anything.
I'm glad all the pieces fell into place. Now, Lauren, like I said, for sure, not least, what was your experience with Craig, Powerpuff Girls? How do you come into the fold for this amazing series?
Well, I came in much later. I think,
third season, somewhere?
That late?
Second.
Like the end of second season, I think.
They all kind of blend together, so we don't even know.
So I came in a little later. I started my career in feature animation as an animator back when people put paper between their fingers.
You animated on Cast of Dance, Cast Iron Giant.
It's an Iron Giant, yeah.
My favorite animated movie of all time.
I did it.
Makes me cry still to this day.
I did a couple memorable things in there, but I was more a junior animator, but it was a great experience. And 2D animation was starting to die, and all my friends who were animators were starting to learn 3D, and I just kind of went, I like to draw. I like to draw with pencils. I like paper. For a few years, I was following, like a few years back, I was watching TV and I saw Dexter's Lab, and I remember thinking, damn, those guys are smart, because they had limited resources, and they went, we don't have a lot of money, so let's design this whole show around that and the way it looks and the way it moves and the way it's done, so that it can look good in its own merit within this budget, because it was surrounded by all these cartoons of people who had feature film designs and really elaborate storyboarding, and they just didn't have the money to make it come through. And then it didn't live up to its potential, and it kind of just looked like crap. And kind of like Linda was saying, I think these were the sorts of things that were making people not like animation and cartoons anymore, because everything on TV was bad. And it wasn't because the people who were making it were bad. They didn't have the money to make it as good as they saw it. So here was this team who went, let's do the best we can with these resources and make it good. And I remember being impressed by that. And then I was working on Iron Giant when Powerpuff Girls came out. And I remember watching the episode, The Rowdy Rough Boys, and I just went, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen ever. I loved the message in it. I started to get like a little weird and obsessed with it. I started like buying shirts and notebooks and toys and stuff. But when, you know, all of my 2D friends were moving on to 3D, and I didn't think I wanted to do that. Our friend Randy Myers, who I knew from Cats and Dance and Iron Giant.
He was one of our directors.
Was directing, yeah, and told me that they were looking for storyboard artists and recommended that I do a test. And I had never storyboarded professionally before, but my storyboard teacher at Cal Arts thought I was good. So I thought maybe I could do it. So I took the test. I was going in once in a while to have Randy take a look at it to see it, and that's when he and I started noticing each other.
Because my office was like looked out at the front door to the bank building, so I saw everybody come in. So I was seeing Lauren come in.
Yeah.
I'm like, who's this woman, this redhead coming in and visiting Randy?
I was too intimidated to talk to him. But yeah, I was getting some feedback from Randy on my stuff before I finally turned it in. And I was super proud to say that Gendy called me the day I turned it in to offer me a position on it. So that was that's how I got in.
Yeah, I remember from my end, I had met Lauren just briefly. She turned in her board. And, you know, I had seen her walking in and just, you know, I'm a 20-something-year-old guy and going, who's this very attractive woman? She hands me her board. And I'm like, oh, it's nice to meet you. And I read it. And I'm like, oh, this is really good. This is great. And I'm like, but I do not feel right about making this decision because my brain is doing other things. So I took it to Gendy and I said, Gendy, check out this board. It's a friend of Randy's. Check this out. He goes, what do you think? And I'm like, just look at it. And I didn't say anything. And he read it and he came out and goes, we should hire her. This is great. And I went, that's what I thought. Give her a job. And so I was like, my conscience was clear. Her work was exceptional. And I remember the test we gave her was part of, I can't remember the name of the episode.
The one where Buttercup has and her blanket.
Yeah, where she had the blanket. And there was a part. So we gave, you know, the way we gave out board tests, we took a chunk of an outline and gave it to people to board. And that episode had already gone into production. And Lauren had done this scene of Buttercup putting her blanket around her neck as a cape. And I was like, how did we miss that? Like, it was like the show was already in production. Somebody had come in and done a test and actually had given us a stronger scene. So I was like, okay, we need her on this show immediately.
For the life of me, I can't remember, but did that scene make it? Is that too late in production?
No, it wasn't, because Riccardi had already boarded it, and it was already in production.
Yeah.
So we had given people part of an outline that was a show that hadn't aired, because we didn't want them to copy and go, hey, look how good I can board on your show. So we wanted to give them something that we had written already, and so that way we could compare their work on the board tests.
Gotcha. Now, with the series being set, obviously you came in three. Chris, you'd been there from the beginning, just rotating over from Dexter. And Linda, you were a driving force to get this from pilot get it onto a series and then going. We'll start with you, Craig. What is your favorite memory, whether it's the pilot, the series, you know, as a party? I know you guys would always go up in the summertime and do them up on the roof. Is there anything that sticks out during the entire production of Powerpuff Girls
to you? The one that probably stuck out is, like, our whole goal making Dexter's Powerpuff was to try to make the best cartoons we possibly could make. And Gendy and I had this philosophy of, like, make the cartoons we thought we watched when we were kids. You know, because a lot of times when you go back and watch the stuff from your childhood, you're like, oh, that really wasn't so great. Like the Warner Brothers and Jay Wood is amazing, and the Hanna-Barbera, that's all great. But other things, you're like, I remember that better. So let's try to make the best thing possible. So when the show first premiered, we had just aired. I remember I got a call from Mike and Linda, and they were like, have you got the LA Weekly yet? And I'm like, what? No. And they're like, go get the LA Weekly. They said it's perfect. The show is perfect. And that's all they needed. Like, the fact that it wasn't about ratings, it wasn't about numbers, it was like, everyone loved it. We did good work, and they loved it. And so that was it for me. Like, we made it, we put it out in the world, people loved it, and they were enjoying it. So I was like, I'll keep doing that. You know, so it was a nice, because it was just nice knowing that people were watching it. Because when we were on Dexter's Laboratory, Cartoon Network only had an East Coast feed, so we, like, never watched it. And so we never watched Dexter's. We couldn't see Cartoon Network, and it was pre-internet, so pre-message boards. So we had no idea what people thought. So when Powerpuff came out, it's kind of the first time we got feedback from an audience. So that was probably the big memory of, like, the fact that Mike and Linda called and were so happy that everyone loved it. And I was like, these are great people to work for. It's just about making great stuff that human beings are entertained by and enjoy. you know.
Boy, oh boy, was it entertaining and joyful. Lauren, what about you? What is your favorite, other than marrying Mr. Craig McCracken over here? I got to imagine that's pretty high up there. But what's one of your favorite memories from the Powerpuff Girls?
You know, it was actually very early on. It was pitching my first storyboard because I was nervous. I was so nervous. I was real young. I think I was 24. I'd never done anything like that before. I was surrounded by all these people I admired and really just uncertain about what I was doing. I was doing the best I could, but I didn't know if I was doing it right. And I had a lot of questions. So when I finally went to pitch it, first of all, I was way too slow. It took way too long to pitch it because I was over explaining everything. But afterwards, everyone on the crew was so complimentary. That was Power Prof was my first one. And when the outline came in, it was to do the front of it, the beginning of it, silent, no dialogue, to show the girls and the professor trying to be together as a family, but being taken apart because the girls had to go save the day. And it was all silent. And everyone told me that I had put a lot of heart into it, that I made it really emotional, that that they felt it, like they felt sad for them. They actually had the emotion of feeling sad. And, you know, Powerpuff is, you know, mostly a comedy with action in it. And I was able to inject this heart into it, and everybody was so appreciative of it. And so like kind and complimentary. And I just felt amazing. I mean, it just felt so validating and good. I'm doing a good job. I belong here. Lifted a lot of self-doubt and made me feel good about myself. And I think that's like one of my, just such a wonderful memory for me.
Well, I can imagine that same joy that you just speak about, and Craig, you speak about. I know Chris and Linda, I'm pretty sure you can echo the same sentiment. That was felt by us fans as well. And I told Craig this the first time he was on, that I had to go around and tell my friends, like, you know, being a guy, you're watching like, oh, you're watching girl cartoons. I'm like, no. This is so fucking cool. I wasn't saying fucking cool when I was like 8 years old. And I'm pretty sure I was, for being honest. But I was like, dude, you got to watch this. It's so cool. They got this dude named Fuzzy Lumpkins, and he sounds like my Uncle Bob. It is insane. I was just Mojo Jojo. He's so cool. He looks like Piccolo, but he's a monkey. You know, so it was all these things that I had to like entice people. And then once my friend saw all of my friends that were boys, they're like, oh my God, this is so good. This is Dexter, but this is with it. There's superpowers and all this other stuff. I was like, yeah, but look at the names, you know, like they have the same names. So we had that same joy that you had. So getting to see that emotion that you put into those boards and getting to hear you relive that is the same thing I feel about when I get to go and put another cartoon up on my wall or go on YouTube or show my kids these cartoons. So Lauren, Linda knows this, and Chris, I think you might have known this, but we had a daughter a year. She just turned a year 2 weeks ago, right? So I have been a fan of not so much the My Little Ponies, but I know that's coming because she already sees the ponies. And then one thing that I absolutely love that you worked on was I'm a huge comic book fan. So I love the DC, the superheroes, right? So getting to watch that with her, she's not at that stage where she's watching stuff just yet. Like she'll watch Sesame Street and she's into that, but I could already feel, because when she comes in here, she'll point to all of this or she'll look at my comic books. So I get to experience Powerpuff Girls with her, with the little girl and with my two sons, but I also get to experience that with a little girl. And because of you guys right here and so many people that I don't have on that are no longer here that I'll never get on, I get to thank you guys for that. So you guys give me the gift of enjoyment with my kids. So I appreciate everything you guys have done.
I got to have that myself with my own daughter. So yeah, when she was four, like she would see the Powerpuff Girls in the house because we have the Warner Brothers statues. And so she's been calling them her sisters since she was born. But we were like, okay, I can't really show her this yet. Yeah. So when she was four, I'm like, I think I can show her the main title. So we put the main title on and she's watching it and she goes, they're superheroes, but they're kids. They're kid superheroes. And so she literally pitched it back to me and I'm like, that's it. That's all.
You got it.
It's there. Like she primally gets why it works. It's viscerally. So like that was a really amazing moment for me to just go, here, watch this. Here's your sisters. and immediately was like, what is that thing? That's incredible. Yeah.
That's so cool. What was her Powerpuff Girl name? Did she ever make one for herself?
Did she make a name?
No. She's drawn herself a bunch of times.
What color is she? Did she pick out one?
Purple.
Yeah.
Right on. Yeah. That's so dope, man. Getting to hear that type of stuff, it's so cool. Great. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. Chris, man, what about you? What is your favorite memory of the Powerpuff Girls production?
Well, there was a moment early on, the show hadn't aired yet, and we had moved from the classic Hanna-Barbera studios into Warner Brothers Animation, but we were separate from the rest of the studio. We were kind of in our own little building, which was kind of cool. And right about when they had finished the main title, the executives had bought like a big sectional couch and a giant big screen TV, the kind that used to be big as a refrigerator, big stereo speakers, just so we could watch all our dailies. And they said, okay, we're going to look at the main title. And that thing popped in on big screen with big sound with the music behind it. And we all just looked at each other and said, oh, this is like really, really good. I mean, we all think, yeah, we're making good cartoons and we like what we're doing, but like, this is really good, you know. And that was like just a moment that we all got to share with each other just before any of the big, popularity of the show with all the toys in the stores. It was just something for all of us as a crew. And it kind of was just a preview of what was to come, not only with how beloved the show was, with a sense of quality, but also just with the public and just being like part of a smash hit like that was really amazing. And that was like our first hint of what it was going to be.
Yeah. And we had like really learned how to make cartoons on Dexter's Laboratory because we had to do 3 7-minutes per half hour. So we just had to make volume and learn how to tell stories, you know, interesting stories in a short period of time. So we did a lot of visual storytelling and like, how do we make this work? So when we were ready to do Powerpuff, I think we all felt ready for this show. Like now we can take everything we've kind of learned on Dexter's and apply it and really kind of do what we've wanted to do.
Man, like I said, you guys crushed it, absolutely crushed it. Linda, what about you? When you think about Powerpuff Girls, is there one moment, one memory that sticks out to you?
You know, I have to admit, the first thing I wrote down on my notes was LA Weekly, because that was like such a key memory. In fact, I teach a class on history of children's television, and that's one of the articles they read. Is that one, because you know it's so significant. But so that is probably one of my biggest memories. And but I have a couple of others right around that time, maybe even before that, maybe like about 3 weeks into the show being on, this guy who was, I guess he was in charge of like off-air art, Gary Albright. And we didn't know each other that well, but he came up to me and he said, so because of Powerpuff Girls, we're going to have to hire a whole bunch of people in the department because there's so many requests for merchandise that we don't have enough people to do it all. And I had this moment of, wait, that sounds good. You're telling me this, like, you know. But it sounds really amazing. And he was like, yeah, it's great. And like, he was very low key. I didn't know him very well at the time, so I didn't know that. But I was like, that's amazing. And I remember feeling like, oh my God, there's going to be merchandise. That's so cool. The other thing I remember is all the bootleg merchandise. That's, you know, that sort of made me feel like, okay, they're ripping us off. It's that good.
Yeah.
There are pinatas. We made it.
What was your favorite bootleg item from Powerpuff Girls? I got to imagine each of you probably has one or seen one that was pretty cool. But Linda, do you have a?
The pinatas were bubbles. Cool. What do you have?
I have a weird marionette bubbles. It's just like a regular human body with bubbles head on it.
Yeah. So what I found at Comic-Con one time was a sheet of stickers, and they had taken Betty Boop's body, and they had put the girls' heads on them alternating. And I was like, okay, I have to buy these, even though this is like burning my eyeballs. I have to buy these and show them to everybody. And everyone was like, ah, that's scary. But like, I was like, I don't know how these got made, but they're so funny. So that was, I think, one of my my favorite thing. A lot of people have come across bootleg merchandise and they've bought it for me. So I have some weird paintings and things, and people will always like, you know, like I was in a store one time and someone had a Powerpuff tattoo. And I was like, oh, I worked on that show. And they were like, you know, show the creator my tattoo, you know, moments like that. And, or like, you know, like people will take pictures of like a bar will have, you know, a drawing of one of the girls just on a, you know, like on a, like a, you know, a chalkboard outside or something. And people will take pictures of that and send it to me. And they're like, check it out. Look, you know, it's still happening. And so I always feel good about that. Like, I feel like this show has had a very long life compared to a lot of other shows that, you know, just kind of come and go. And, you know, there's something about Powerpuff Girls, and it's not that it's had remakes or anything. It's just that, you know, it's sort of in the
zeitgeist.
You know? Yeah. It's part of pop culture where a lot of other shows just kind of came and went. And so, so I like that, you know, I like that people think of it as like a show they grew up with and they talk about it still.
So, it's usually my default when people are like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I make cartoons. Oh, anything I've heard of? I'm like, have you heard of the Powerpuff Girls? That's always the one. Oh. That's the one everybody's heard of. Yeah.
How often have you tried to use that to get out of a ticket, Craig? You ever try to throw that out?
Never. No, not at all.
Maybe next time. Chris, what about you? Before we rotate into the fans' questions, is there any piece of bootleg merchandise that you've seen with the Powerpuff Girls that actually tickled your fancy?
I can't say there's much bootleg stuff, but actually the stuff that really got me excited was always seeing the legit stuff that came from Japan, because they went like really all out. They had full play sets featuring like not just the main characters, but they had like Talking Dog and him and the mayor, everybody. And I think I have a copy of a book. Like when I was a teenager and was getting into anime, I would have to go down to Little Tokyo and get these books. It was a book series called This Is Animation, where it would have all the model sheets and backgrounds and screen grabs of the shows. And they had a whole book that was all about the Powerpuff Girls. And I think that was the only book I ever actually found outside of, like, you know, the little golden books that Craig did, but like an actual animation book on Powerpuff. And I'm like, man, this is, I feel legit. This is something I used to buy as a kid.
So. Yeah. Is that the guide? Is that the Japanese guide?
Yeah. 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 It was like Powerpuff Girls Perfect Guide.
Like when I need to refer to episodes, like what did we do? I pull up that Japanese guide. And I'm like, where would do that in?
Yeah, yeah.
Very thorough and very useful.
Oh, that's pretty dope, man. So before we rotate this fans question, I never worked on the show, but I've got a very fun production. And I heard it from both Craig, because I had to corroborate Chris Battle's story over here when Chris was on. My favorite story about Powerpuff Girl Productions, hearing it from you guys, was Gendy was very upset. I think you guys were all playing Zelda. And then everybody was going behind on boards. So he had to sit down with everybody and say, hey, hey, hey. And then I remember, I think it was you, Craig, you said, all right, does anybody need help so we can finish this game and we can move on?
We both sat down. So Chris talked about that big couch. So everybody was doing their stint on Ocarina of Time. Some people were doing it like in 4 a.m. or whatever. And every board artists, model designers, everybody was playing it. My directors were playing it. I was playing it. So, like, we had to sit down at one point and say, like, where is everybody on the game? Who needs help? How do we take care of this? And Gendy was like, it shouldn't be happening. You shouldn't be doing this. I'm like, Gendy, we are going to finish this game because we are all obsessed with this. But I just need to figure out who's close, who needs help. And maybe, and I remember things like, Andy, why don't you come in early in the morning and play, like, get here. Like, we were, like, trying to strategize. And Gendy wasn't playing it at all. But we all were, and we loved it. So we had to, like, get through it in order to get back on schedule. There are other things that kept us off schedule because we were obsessive and crazy and trying to make the best cartoon we possibly could. So we would hold it up for other reasons. But, you know, that was one of the big ones.
Yeah, it was that one in Super Smash. Yeah, that one in not Super Smash Brothers. Excuse me, Mario Kart were my two favorite stories.
Mario Kart. There
were daily Mario Kart competitions at that couch.
Who was your racer? Who'd you like using, Craig?
I think I just chose Mario. I didn't have time to play the game. It was like I had to make the show. But like, you know, Dave Smith and Andy Bialk and Chris, you were playing a lot, right? Yeah. Who else was?
Yeah. Cindy would play, probably Carrie.
Were there. Yeah.
Who was your racer, Chris?
Yoshi.
Yoshi. Lauren, did you ever partake in the Mario Kart?
I think I did. And I think I was Yoshi too.
Yoshi. I was always a Donkey Kong guy. There's two games I don't lose. Well, there's three games I don't lose. And Mario Kart, Super Smash Brothers, and any of the NBA games. So it's a sickness more than anything. But I love me some Mario Kart. I have no problem. That's tough love right there. You don't let your kids win. You make them cry over Mario Kart. You know you're racing them right. You know what I mean? Cutthroat around here.
It was good for the crew. It was good, team building and camaraderie. And it was
absolutely
a good break and get away from it and do something fun together.
Broke the ice for me with a lot of people because I was there all shy and full of anxiety. So I had something to like bond with people over a little.
Beautiful. Well, it's always fun to break everybody's spirit and bond together over Mario Kart because that's what we do here. All right, so we're going to rotate into this some of these fans' questions. Ladies and gentlemen, there was a lot, so we will not be able to answer or ask all of them, but we will ask as many as we can. Now, we asked this one with Fred at the beginning. So, Craig, I figure we can start with you. If you've known what you know now, what would you tell your younger self to do differently during the earliest parts of your career?
I would tell myself to slow down and learn. Because I mean, I'm pretty obsessive and I've been eager to when I was 12 years old, I said, I'm going to grow up and be a professional cartoonist and make cartoons that people know throughout the world. Like I just said that to myself and was dedicated to it. But in that process of doing it, I didn't really learn a lot of the technical stuff. I wish I knew Photoshop better. I wish I knew some of this technical stuff better. Like, and some of that is just slowing down and learning ins and outs of how to use these tools. And I kind of get impatient with that. So I wish I had learned to slow down. And I wish I had learned, to go back to what I learned on Neat Fuzzy Lumpkins, the problem was wrong with those shorts is Neat Fuzzy Lumpkins was like episode 7 of season 4 of a show that everybody had been watching for 2 years. Right. And I really failed at telling the kids who the Powerpuff Girls were, why they had superpowers, what are they doing, what are they all about. I just threw them in the deep end and they were confused. And I think they wanted to know about it, but I was doing them a disservice because I wasn't going back and telling the story from the beginning. Because even though I had been developing it in my head since 1992, my audience didn't know that. And so that's been the one lesson I've learned about my work is I don't necessarily get to be the person that's entertained by it. I'm the entertainer. My job is to tell the story, go back to the beginning, and walk you through it. And even though I know it's like being a magician and I know how to do the trick, right? It's that sort of thing. But I don't get to be excited by the trick. I get to do the trick. So like when I was younger, I think I was more like, no, I just want to make something that I think is funny. And I didn't think about my audience. But when I got older, I learned to you got to communicate to your audience. You have a responsibility to them to tell your story.
I'm glad you got to tell that story, man. Because like I said, every story you've ever told, I've been thoroughly enjoyed and entranced with. So Lauren, how about you? What's one thing you would go back and tell your younger self?
You know, what's kind of interesting is I feel sort of the same as Fred when he answered that he took his own advice because coming onto Powerpuff Girls was a big turning point for me. Looking back at the kind of artist I was and the kind of colleague I was on the movies that I had worked on, Cats Don't Dance and Iron Giant, I came to Powerpuff going, I can't be so quiet. I can't be so shy. I need to put myself out there. I need to let people know I exist. I need to give myself, make sure that I get my credit, not be so humble, right? And this is the kind of advice I give young women now, young women going into the business. They're just like, don't be humble because you're the girl and everyone will believe you. it's like, take your credit where credit is due and point out the good things that you did. And a big thing for me too was I was so intimidated by my superiors that I didn't get to know them. And I told myself, I got to stop it or my career will never come together
if I just continue to be this little wilting, terrified flower. And hilariously, the first person I did that with was him. And then look that what happened, out. Right?
24 years later.
Right? He was like, okay, I can't be scared of him. I just need to talk to him. And then lo and behold.
And right? we made a human together.
Yeah. So that was, and like I said, it's like that's the kind of advice I give young women now is you have to be you know, not just put yourself out there. Like another piece of advice I give them is like, you know, interrupt because nobody's going to slow down and go, hold on, everybody. What does the one girl in the room have to say? You know, it's mm-hmm. it. So I went into this job with those telling myself I needed to do those things. And, you know, it worked out. My time at Cartoon Network was my, like the happiest time. I had no idea how lucky we had it. Yeah. The freedom that we had and the lack of interference. I just thought that's how it all worked. Yeah. And then I go out into the rest of the animation world. I'm like, what is happening? So that's, I guess I would tell my pre-Powerpuff younger self, do what you're thinking. Because that works.
Because those are, I mean, those days at Cartoon Network, it really was a different place. Like if I had an idea for consumer products or an on-air promo, I could call up Gary Albright or Ed Marietta or Michael Olean and go, hey, I have this idea. Like it was really, it felt like a mom and pop animation studio. Like everybody knew each other. And in my experience going to other studios, I was like, oh, this is not like Cartoon Network at all. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. It might take you 6 months to get a meeting with somebody, where in the Cartoon Network, I just call somebody on the phone and we go to lunch together and hang out. It was very collaborative, even with the folks in Atlanta. Like we all were working together.
Well, speaking of collaborative for just 1 second, Chris and Linda, we'll get to you just on that same question. This has been something I've been extremely fascinated about. You know, so we've had this talk about, you know, animation being collaborative, right? It's there's so many cooks in the kitchen, right? For you in particular, being the creator of Powerpuff Girls, how do I ask this question? How do you collaborate, but it's still a Craig McCracken cartoon, if that makes any sense? Like, when do you know what to sacrifice and what hill to die on is what I'm getting at.
You basically have to accept the fact that the show, because I have it in my head. I can see it in my head. It's just the way my brain works. I can see it. You have to accept that it will naturally grow and evolve into a new thing that is better than what I conceived of it when I let other people share their talent and their ideas. And mm-hmm. My job is sort of to just go watch it as it's growing and try to like trim it where it needs
nurture
to grow.
It.
Let it grow, like let it be what it wants and let the artists who are contributing to it feel like they have some ownership of it. And like I've always said, at the end of the day, my job is just what I say yes to and what I say no to. We're not going to make that episode. We're not going to do that gag, but we're going to do this and we're going to do that. But all those ideas are coming from other people. And I just need to be open to the collaboration. Like I had mentioned in an award speech, I always wanted to be in a band. Right. Mm-hmm. I love collaborating with people and I love that energy that happens when you work with other people. And going back to what you said earlier, that you picked up on, you know, the shows felt good to you. I'm a mm-hmm. firm believer that the energy that you put into a project actually comes out in the project. It's why yes. people love the Beatles. It's why people love the Muppets. You can feel the joy in those creative people executing the work. It's subtle. It's like another level of, like, you know, I watch Looney Tunes or Jay Ward and I'm like, those guys had fun. I can mm-hmm. feel the fun they're having coming off the screen, and I think that's part of it.
Well, thank you for answering that.
And that's like you can't create that stuff. You have to create an environment like Mike and Linda created for us
and harness it.
We can play and do that stuff.
Well, thank you for breaking that down. That's been a question that I've had on the back of my mind for probably since the last time you were on about 2 years ago. And it's like, next time Craig gets on, I'm glad I texted it to myself multiple times.
It will so. Be its own thing, and you have to let it, like, it's like your kids, right? Your kids are going to be who your kids are going to be, and your job is just to nurture them and guide them. So
boy, oh boy, They're going to be who they want to be for sure. I've noticed. I've got, like I said, I've got three of them, a 14-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. My God, yeah. Are they so different.
Yeah. It's a hard thing to say to executives. They're like, what's the show going to be like? And I'm like, I don't know.
Here's where we're going to start
making it.
But who knows where it's going.
It'll be good. I guarantee you. I've got good people and we'll make good stuff. I can guarantee you that. But I don't know how it'll ultimately feel.
Oh, man. Chris, what about you, though? What's one piece of advice you'd tell younger Chris?
Yeah. I would say loosen up your drawing style. Because early on, because unlike so many of the other people on the show, I didn't go to CalArts. I didn't work on shows like Ren and Stimpy. I'd have a couple jobs before that, but I still didn't have that same level of skill. And it was really like leveling up. It's like, I always say, it's like being like a good college athlete and all of a sudden going to the pros. I'm like, whoa, I was trying so hard to make like the perfect crisp line work and the perfect graphic drawing styles. They're like, you know, dude, you need to like, you know, get the job done a little bit quicker because we're on a deadline here. And they said, we got really great cleanup artists who are going to make your drawings look pretty. And it was like a couple years later, I finally learned to just loosen up my drawing style. And everything really flowed then. So I probably would have had like saved myself 3 years of stress earlier that way and gotten some nicer drawings out of it.
Chris is a phenomenal designer, but it was like, we don't need them cleaned up. Just give us your roughs and then you could do more. Adding this extra step. Don't do that extra step. We don't need it. Do more drawings because you're so good.
And even now, when I still do rough things and do it loose, now my stuff, now just because I know better, I'm a better designer. People say, oh my God, it's so neat and clean. I'm like, no, really, this is pretty loose, you know, but
that's just what comes out.
Yeah. Yeah. And then other than that, I would probably tell myself to really concentrate more on learning how to draw hands better. It's so hard. Thankfully, looking at Craig and Paul Rudish's artwork, I was able to find good shorthand for doing good action hands and stuff like that.
That's really cool, man. What about you, Linda? What's one thing you tell your younger self?
There's so much I want to tell my younger self. stop worrying. But I think the biggest mistake that I made had a lot to do with working in cable. And, you know, working in cable, particularly in the 80s, where it was so competitive, so hardcore, and there was a sort of a vibe that you had to convince everyone around you that you knew exactly what you were doing. And I don't know that there's any way any of us could have known what we were doing. You know, maybe you had a similar experience, but, you know, none of us really had any clue. But I suddenly moved from programming to animation, and I was just a fan. I had never worked in the industry. I'd watched a lot, but, you know, I hadn't worked in the industry. And I was constantly trying to convince people that I knew what I was doing. And the truth is, I don't know that I knew exactly what I was doing. So I probably should have asked more questions and should have taken more time. Yeah. You know, to really learn from people and to really just kind of be honest about, you know, what I knew and what I didn't know. And instead, you know, I, like many other people, we were all just very consumed with, you know, seeming like we knew exactly what we were doing and how to do it. And, you know, we did these things and they generally worked out. So I guess we kind of knew what we were doing. But, you know, I remember like constantly feeling like I was trying to convince people that I knew what I was doing. And, you know, in later years, I've had people working in my departments who've tried to convince me that they know what they're doing. And I've been like, calm down, we're good. Just focus on the work. And I hired you, so I'm good. And I've realized, you know, I was probably just like them when I was that age. And it's like, oh man, you know, that's awful. But so I guess, you know, just calm down, learn from people. You know, it is a better work environment now than it used to be. You know, the 80s were tough. The 90s were hardcore. You know, I mean, would you guys agree? It's gotten a little calmer. You know, people are a little calmer. I mean, we know what we're doing for the most part. like, you know, people know how to make shows now. Like there's a way you make a show, even if you have a lot of varieties of that, but there's a basic way you make a show. And we all kind of know that. But we didn't really know that back, you know, in the early 90s. And so there was this sense of, you know, you better convince people that you know what you're doing or else, you know, they won't listen to you. So I remember just constantly being, you know, and I mean, maybe they would call that imposter syndrome. I don't know. But, you know, whatever it is, I would go back to myself and say, calm down. It's going to be fine. Just read a book or something. Learn this stuff.
Just keep swimming.
Yeah, right.
You know, so the Beatles was a huge, Beatles was such a huge episode for so many people. And I know, Linda, we've talked Beatles, Craig, we've talked Beatles, and Fred, we talked Beatles. I don't think Beatles have come up with you, Chris, but I have to imagine, you know, you guys got to see this episode, make this episode to an extent, but there's a lot of people that wrote in about it. Did Ringo Starr really want to be a Powerpuff Girl?
Well, that was in Dance Pants, which was done after I left. Dave Smith and Kevin Dart did that. Kevin Dart art directed it, but yeah, I wasn't involved in the Dance Pants episode at all.
Heard that,
but yeah, but I think he did, according to the song in the episode. Yeah.
With that being said, was it hard to push a Beatles episode though with the Beatles? Was it hard to push that at all?
No, because we reached a certain point with Cartoon Network, like they just trusted us to do what we wanted to do and make the episodes we wanted to make. And, you know, the Beatles episode, I think, was my idea. And my main caveat was like, look, we can't just make this be Beatles references and completely go over kids' heads. So it needs to work on two levels. The kids need to watch a cartoon about the villains teaming up and being able to defeat the Powerpuff Girls. And then mom and dad watching get all the other references. Because that, like, to me, the biggest inspiration for Powerpuff Girls was 66 Batman. And that show worked on two levels. So when it came time to do Meet the Beatles, it's like, we have to do this. And I remember I gave it to Dave Smith. And Dave Smith's hilarious and one of our top funny board guys on the show. And he's a massive Beatles fan and music fan. And I said, Dave, whatever you do, don't watch the complete Beatles and just copy scenes verbatim with our characters. Anyway, don't worry, I won't. I'm like, tell a Powerpuff story. And I remember this. We're walking into the pitch. He and I are passing each other going in, and he goes, you're going to hate me. And I'm like, oh, man. Because part of what happened with the board guys on our crew, they wanted to make funny shows, but they also wanted to make all their friends laugh in the room. So which created brilliant stuff oftentimes, but sometimes it created like, this is only going to make sense to a really small amount of people and kids are going to be confused. So I just took it and rewrote it. Like I just treated it as an assignment and like, took all the lyrics from Beatles songs and grabbed all the iconic ones. Like, okay, you've got Mojo and Get Back. All right, I've got that. And like, Help. Okay, we need help. So you start just grabbing all the iconic Beatles lines and then just start writing it going, I need something to like this. And so you just start referencing the lyrics. And that's sort of, it was like a little puzzle for me to write it and put it together. And I think I used some of what Dave had done in his board, but I kind of made it more of a dual episode that worked on both levels, you know. And it was just a fun little puzzle to try to solve.
And it was full disclosure. But
I became a Beatles fan when I was probably 6 or 7, and like the way I discovered the Beatles is my mom and my sister had all the albums. But they also had the Ruddles album. So I discovered the Beatles and the Ruddles at the same time. So in my mind, they're linked. Like the Monty Python and the Beatles are all the same thing. So it was like making a funny Beatles thing was just like, well, that makes sense. That's what you do. Because the Ruddles already parodied it. And that's how I learned about parody and all of those
albums. When I was 5, I didn't know the difference between the Beatles and the Monkees. Right. They were the same band. And yeah. I remember watching Yellow Submarine at like age six and saying, okay, so is this the Beatles or the Monkees? Like, they're all the same to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I liked it all, but I really didn't know the difference. But kids do enter the Beatles universe pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
Of all their young sounding songs. So, so to me, it just seemed like I thought it was brilliant. You know, I just, and I'm, of course, I'm a huge Beatles fan, but, you know, still, you know, I've seen enough Beatles stuff that's not brilliant. And, you know, I could tell the difference. And I just loved it. But do you remember I called you and I was like, what is this Someday Monkey Play Piano song? And I thought your answer was so funny.
Yeah, that was my misinterpretation of the French from Michelle, right? So I don't know what he was saying. So I always assumed he was saying someday monkey won't play piano song. Because as a kid, I didn't know French. So those were the lyrics I wrote for it. So that was like an inside baseball like reference that only I knew.
Right. But that's what I loved about it. It had those moments in it, you know? And it's you know, I knew that, you know, we had something pretty amazing with that episode too. So no, there was no controversy about it or anything. Everybody was just like, wow, that's amazing. And because it really works. It really works as a story.
Mm-hmm. And okay. I always know the references. I like those little challenge episodes, those little puzzles. Like we did an episode of Dexter's called Dim. And my idea was, no dialogue through the whole thing, just visual storytelling. It was inspired by this sketch that was on Mr. Show called Coupon the Movie. If you'd ever seen Coupon the Movie, it was a trailer for a movie about buying socks. And I thought it was amazing. So I was like, let's do a Dexter's like that. So like a lot of times when I would do these episodes, I was like, let's come up with this cool challenge. Let's try to do this. So Beatles was one of those, like, let's try to do a Beatles reference episode. You know, and we would do that a lot on Powerpuff and Dexter's, just experimental filmmaking, you know. On Wander, we did that too. Like, let's do two cartoons simultaneously and you're watching both at the same time. Like, I like those kind of challengey episodes. They're fun to make.
Well, I will say, watching the Beatles, I was never a Beatles fan. I don't want to say I am yet, but I am coming around to the idea that I might have been wrong on the Beatles for all of my life. So I guess that's growth is what I'm getting at, ladies and gentlemen. I watched this episode not too long ago and I was like, man, that was actually pretty cool. I wonder how close that is to the source material. Did they change up any lyrics or anything like that? And I started listening to it. And by the time I realized it, I'm like, wow, I'm like 30 minutes into this album and I haven't turned it off yet. So I was like, either one, I've become numb to it, or two, I'm starting to like it. I haven't ruled out either one just yet.
It's really good. The Beatles are really good for human beings. You should check them.
I'm gonna check them out again. I'm gonna keep this train going. If you could rewrite one episode from the 98 series, which would it be, and how would it change?
Wow. I don't know. I think there's certain things, like I look at Twisted Sister and go, oh, that's really uncomfortable. Even though we were doing Frankenstein, there's certain things like that, like that's maybe not good. And there's also, there's some really violent ones. Like, we won't show our daughter all of them. And some of the him episodes get pretty dark. Yeah, it's like there was some. But I don't have any regrets, because it's like that's where we were at that time. And we were making that. And that also was the humor at the time. That's, you know, things evolve and change over time.
Right on. Lauren, what about you?
I mean, that's the whole point of being an artist, is you're constantly trying to grow as an artist and get better and better and better. You know?
Yeah, that's the whole goal, man. Be innovative and learn, like you said, learn from past mistakes, learn from past successes.
I was told at a very young age that if any artist was ever 100% satisfied with what they do, there's no reason to keep doing it. So no. That little bit of, I could have done that better, that's what makes you make the next thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I want to say I would like to get better, but I think hate motivates me a little bit more. I'm like, dude, I know I can do that plate better. And, you know, cooking for Lego, I know I could have seasoned that better. So that's what drives me.
But that's
more
what
hate, so, you know.
Children. I mean, honestly, that's what motivated us as kids.
Yeah.
I can do this better. I can
absolutely.
You know, I can do
absolutely.
This.
Lauren, what about you? I know you didn't write too much. I mean, you wrote with some storyboards because a lot of these were board-driven. So,
yeah,
did you?
So we wrote and boarded, which is why it was easy for me to move into scripts afterwards for shows like Foster's. But I have so many weird mixed feelings about Equal Fights, and I just kind of wish we didn't make it.
Gotcha.
You know, it's not even rewriting it. It probably just shouldn't have done it.
I remember it's when we were going over the board, Gendy did speak up one time and just said, I don't think we should make this one.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, it turned out really good and it's a wonderful message, but it's like, it's kind of heavy for
It's that heavy show. And it was misinterpreted. Some stuff was misinterpreted and I guess it went through the pipeline. There were like some redraws that other people did that were kind of against what the message of the story was. It's like, I don't know. I just wish we didn't.
You know what I would do different? I wouldn't make the movie so dark. I wouldn't have made the movie so intense and dark. Because I think
that's a better answer.
That's the real answer. Because it's like what had happened, like Powerpuff became huge. But then a lot of the merchandise was like jewelry kits and makeup and dress ups. And I'm like, this has nothing to do with superheroes. So I remember when we were developing a movie, we had this feeling of we wanted to reclaim the superhero and the action aspect of Powerpuff. And I remember Mike told us, he's like, we want you to make this movie for 25-year-old guys. So we went, really? Okay. And in hindsight, I'm like, I really should have thought about the kids too. You know, I should have like kept some of the fun tone of the TV show. And I look back and like that the balance on that was a little off. It's beautiful and it was well done, but it was like it was too heavy.
Yeah, well I just rewatched it for the first time probably about a year ago. And I don't know if it's just because I'd watched it as a kid, well teenager at that time, and then I'm watching it as an adult. I'm just sitting there going, God, this is so great getting to relive my childhood again. You know, I was just sitting there just amazed. You know, weed helps too. I was sitting there. I had a couple edibles and I'm like, oh my God, this is, I wish I could go back and watch this again for the first time as a kid. You know, so I had such fun with it, you know.
I hear that a bit. Like I'm hearing the kids that did see it and did watch it, like especially animation fans really appreciate it. I know Ben Boclay, who's a creator of Gumball, is a big fan. So that means a lot. Like he's told me that. So I'm like, there are people who are in the industry and in the know who acknowledge it's, you know, it's creative achievement. So that does mean a lot.
Yeah, I just saw a thread on Twitter the other day where people were just going on about like, you know, that can we talk about how good the design and the visuals are in this movie? And it's a lot of screen grabs. People were chiming in on that. So
I haven't seen it since we delivered it. Honestly, I haven't watched it.
You know, it's worth a rewatch. Actually aged well. I remember watching it with my kids at one point, and at the end of it, I was like, you know, this is really good. And they agreed. And I don't think they understood why I was having that thought. But I remember, you know, like just thinking, oh, you know, and it wasn't like, oh, this is better than I remember. It was like, oh, that was really good. And I think we were tough on it because it was our first movie. And, you know, if we'd made 10 movies, you know, we would have been good at it by the end of them. But, you know, this was our first. And you know, I think it was really the only actual feature. And I did learn almost immediately. No, parents showed up with their 6-year-olds and that's who we should have been making this for. And they thought it would be funny and it wasn't funny. And, you know, it wasn't funny in the right way. And, you know, so I think we all learned a lot from that, but, you know, it holds up. That's the main thing is you watch it and you're like, wow, this is good. And so you should watch it, you know, and you'll be like, oh, good. I did this.
I've learned, we've learned so much more about story structure and long form storytelling. Like the way we did that was just like straight ahead. There was no script on that movie. It was like, Don, you take a chunk, Paul, you take a chunk, Charlie, Lauren, me, we're going to go. Do you remember that pitch? Do you remember how we pitched it to you? It took like 3 hours and probably filled like 5 or 6 conference rooms. We kept going up the elevators and over to this one, hallway. Yeah, we pitched the entire movie to Mike and Linda.
Yeah, no, I do remember that. And it was a lot. But I think, you know, we up till that point, we had trusted you guys, so we just kept going along with that, you know. And I certainly didn't know how to make a movie. I mean, you know, we only knew anything about movies from watching them. So,
yeah.
You know, so I think, you know, in the end, I think we did a good job. You know, I think you made a great movie. It just, you know, at the time, I think there were other expectations for what it would be.
Right. But we also found out that boys were afraid to go see it.
Right.
Really?
Big part of it. They didn't want to
cowards
going buying a Powerpuff Girls ticket. You know, I think that would be different today, though, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think
so. Oh, 100%. I mean, Lauren, you know better than anybody, the Brony community is outstanding. I mean, I've watched a little bit of it with my daughter, but she's just one and she just wants to see everything that's around the house. But, you know, I was amazed, you know, just going to a comic book store and then seeing guys walk in with Brony shirts and seeing guys buy the Brony comics. And I'm just like, oh my God, I deployed and like everything changes. Like I would have gotten beaten up if I would have liked that. I would have got beaten. Well, I didn't get beaten up as a Powerpuff Girls fan, but it's like, I definitely got looked at weird until all of my friends came over and seen that. So, but I never really thought that, you know, boys were afraid to go see that. I mean, I know I wasn't. I, like I said, I was hook, line, and sinker for Powerpuff Girls from day one. But that was probably just not the norm. You know, I was just a different kid. But yeah, like I said, I watched this movie last year and it was fun. You guys absolutely crushed it. I mean, it's stunning. Looking at that now, you know, even with, you know, the reformatting and then now everything is HD and the TVs have gotten so much better now. But it's just like everything just went off the screen. Like you hit it and like, oh my God, they threw every dollar that Cartoon Network ever had at this movie. And I'm like, it paid off. So like I said, I love the movie. Worth a rewatch, Craig. I hope you can go back and find some enjoyment in it.
I will. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
beautiful. All right. So I figure we can end it with this one because I've already kept you guys for an hour and a half and I apologize for that. But Crazy About SpongeBob wanted to know, and we're going to do this question for each of you. Linda, we'll start with you. Which episode do you think has the best fight scene?
Oh, I don't know. This is a tough question for me because I just glossed over the fight scenes and
those were so cool for me as a kid.
Yeah, I don't know that I can answer that very well because they all seemed good. They all.
Yeah.
I just remember a lot of teeth flying, things like that. So I'm gonna defer on this because I don't know that I have a good answer.
What about you, Chris? What was your favorite fight scene in the series?
I think in Bubble Vicious when Bubbles is in the holodeck turned up to 11. Yeah. And there's, I just remember there's like various body parts getting chopped off. She pulls the spike off of a creature, off of a kaiju, rams it through the back of his head, through his open mouth. And there's a shot of a bouncing eyeball. It's great.
She was hardcore, right? That was her.
Hardcore. Beautiful.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
Chris, what about you, Lauren?
He took my answer. Chris did it. For all the reasons he said. Like I'm making Linda the same way. I gloss over the fight sequences unless the fight has a plot point or a story point in the middle of it. I don't like fighting for just fighting's sake. And you know, Powerpuff fight sequences were generally kind of short.
Yeah.
But the one that burns into your brain is Bubble Vicious. You know what? The Rowdy Rough Boys was pretty good too, but for me, that's mostly because how they ended the fight.
Yeah.
And I think that was the episode that hooked me onto the series, and it was because of the end of that fight, and just the concept of being equally matched, but the girls could win it with their girlish charms and being affectionate, and that the boys couldn't handle the booties was, yeah. So I guess that'll be my answer since Chris took my first one.
Beautiful. What about you, Craig? I figure we'll finish it with you.
Well, I mean, it definitely, again, Bubble Vicious is kind of the most iconic one. So, I mean, Rowdy Rough Boys has an amazing fight. Dynamo has an insane action sequence. That was supposed to be an 11-minute, and Don just went, no. And, like, we couldn't even figure out how to cut it, so we sent it to Mike and Linda. We're like, this is great. And then we got a call back going, okay, you can make 22s now. So, like, we knew we could do that. But, yeah, Bubble Vicious is, to me, like, the most iconic episode, because it's, I always said the secret of Powerpuff is sweet and sour. Like, so it's cute being tough. And that episode really sums that up, you know, perfectly. Bubbles, which is the cutest that one, contrasts. Being hardcore. I mean, I remember when we were recording Insecticide, which was the first episode, and at the very end of the episode, Tara has a line where she says, "Who are you calling a biped?" And she screamed it in the cutest voice ever, and like had this crack in her voice. And I remember when we got that take, Gendy looked at me and went, "That's the show." And I went, yeah. "Yep, that's the show." So, and that's why we made, you know, Bubble Vicious. We're like, let's take an episode and really shine a light on this contrast with Bubbles, because she's sort of the tropiest of the Powerpuff Girls. She's the cutest. It's funnier to see her be the toughest. But yeah, that fight was bananas.
Tag in the movie was pretty good.
It's
not really a fight, but there's a really great action.
But we had to make a lot of changes to Tag. Like, I remember that it's a really tragic story, but Lazo was visiting us while we were in production of the movie, and this was on like a Friday, and it was in September of 2021. And I'm like, look at this effects animation we've got. Look at these. The girls are flying through buildings, trying to, Buttercup doesn't want to fly around the buildings, so she's just going to beeline through the buildings, blow up all these buildings. I remember showing Lazo these incredible effects we had animated by Dave Kupchak. And that was on a Friday, and Monday was September 11th. And all of a sudden, these, what we saw were cartoony, exaggerated things you don't see in real life, was suddenly our world. Real. We were just like,
oh, it's not fun anymore.
And so we had to change, not that it's a problem, obviously, we had to change a lot of stuff, but it's like, it was suddenly like, okay, this is no longer a joke. This is no longer cartoony. Yeah. We've got to be serious about this.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I don't think I've ever heard that story, man. And thank you guys so much for your time. So,
on a 9/11 note.
Don't worry. I'm gonna save this one for you, Craig. Don't worry about that. That's my job. But Linda, I want to say thank you for being one of those people that I can always reach out to, and it doesn't matter. I hold you and Robert Alvarez in the same breath. You two are two of the people that I can go to and ask you a question, ask you the character of somebody if I'm ever having somebody on my show, and you guys can point me in the right direction I need. You always cut the fat. There's no bullshit with either one of you guys, and you guys have always been there to answer my goofy animation questions. So thank you, Linda, for being you. I really appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
Absolutely. I'm glad you do it too. Chris, man, you said it yourself. You've got some of the cleanest artwork, even though some of them are your roughest, man. I love looking at your Instagram and everything you post. Your artwork is second to none, and you're one of my favorite guests I've ever gotten the chance to break down character design. So thank you for that. Lauren, this is the first time we've met. But like I said, there's going to be many years of me getting to enjoy your work. I really hope, I know you and Craig are working together on quite a few things. I really hope that what you guys set out to make, you guys get to make. I really appreciate you doing the girl-centric shows like the My Little Ponies and then the DC Soup. I before I even had a daughter, I fell in love with that show. Just getting to see the characters that you don't get to see all the time. My favorite, it's not DC, it's Marvel, but my favorite Marvel character of all time has always been She-Hulk. I've been so fascinated with Jen Walters. She is such a badass character, and she never gets her. I would love to see, Lauren, I'm trying to pitch you. Please go to Marvel and do some She-Hulk stuff. I would love to see it, especially with your work.
When the live action show came out, I called my agents and they said, can you figure out a way to get me on that? Because I even saw they were using some concepts that I was like, we did that, superhero girls. I have more ideas. Call me. You know, but they were
maybe for season two, they might reach out. I'm hoping we get a season two, because I had such, like I said, such affinity for that character. So thank you for doing what you do. Craig, man, like I said, you created my childhood. You created my teenage years. You gave me such a great. When I look back and I think about all the times as a little kid sitting in front of the TVs, not once did I ever sit there and go, man, that was dull. That was boring. You kept me invested in front of a TV a lot longer than most people could. So I appreciate everything you've done for me, man. It really means a lot.
Well, good. Thank you. Well, we have a symbiotic relationship because I need people like you watching the things I make. So I appreciate you tuning in and watching all these years and enjoying it. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well,
Julian, thanks for bringing us together. This was great. Yes.
It's been a long time.
Yeah. It's been a long time. Yeah, this is fun.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully this will spawn many more chats for you guys. Like I said, we just did the cow and chicken one. The goal is to do quite a few more of these stretched across Cartoon Network, Disney, and Nickelodeon. So who knows, man? We might have to do this. I don't want to have to wait, you know, almost 30 years for you guys to do it again. So we'll have to do it a lot sooner. Excuse me. I butchered the English language there. Sure. But I had an absolute blast talking to every single one of you guys, man. Thanks. She's been Linda. That's been Chris. That's been Lauren and Craig. This has been Julian. It's been What's My Head podcast. And this has been another piece of your childhood. Good night.
Thanks.
Hey guys, it's your resident cartoon junkie Brandon Jones here, asking you to have a listen to my Animation Destination podcast. It's an animation celebration podcast, and it's full of all sorts of stuff about anime and cartoons and voice acting and all that sort of thing, and just a really all-around celebration of anything animated. So come on by and check it out. We've got fan episodes of favorite animes to your most obscure cartoons on Netflix that no one's ever heard of, and just really love talking about it. You can subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes and anywhere else you can get your podcasts from. So stop on by, subscribe, and stay tuned for the Animation Destination Podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we go, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with the podcast today. I truly appreciate every download and listen we get. If you're liking what we're doing, drop us a 5-star rating, drop us a review, tell a friend, and I'll see you next week.